May it please the court. My name is Andrew Hare. I represent Sandra Jacobson. I'm going to focus my argument this afternoon on argument one and set forth in the briefs concerning the trial court's failure to canvass the jury after defense counsel asked the court to do so following a lengthy record regarding the mid-trial media report concerning Ms. Jacobson's lengthy criminal driving record. This report appeared, according to the record, on both TV and on the internet. Harper has been around for about almost 25 years. It sets forth a simple three-prong process that a trial court is required to engage in when counsel brings to the court's attention a mid-trial media report. The first prong, the principal focus, really is about the potential for prejudice with respect to the report that's at issue. In this particular case, I just want to recount very briefly the report that was on Channel 4 and appeared again on TV and on the internet. It concerned Ms. Jacobson.
Well, let me stop you there.
Sure.
The report isn't in the record.
The actual television news report and internet report is not in the record, no, Your Honor.
Well, there's nothing in the record other than what defense counsel in the lower court discussed, correct?
Correct. The defense counsel recounted exactly what was on the report. He said he watched it twice. The trial court listened. The trial court didn't disagree. In fact, the court added to the events that occurred in the report in terms of details about the criminal record of Ms. Jacobson. And so the court did not disagree. In fact, added to and supplemented this report. It concerned her prior conviction for DUI. It concerned prior convictions for accidents involving injury. It concerned prior driving under suspensions. One part of the report indicated that she was driving under suspension at the time of the events in question here, the charged offenses, and on a previous occasion. It also indicated that one of the witnesses or one of the persons interviewed were pleading for a particular sentence for Ms. Jacobson, thereby indicating her guilt for the charged offenses. Part of the factors in deciding and considering whether or not the information is inherently prejudicial is a question of, one, is it admissible? None of these things was admissible in Ms. Jacobson's trial. They're not admissible at all.
Why wouldn't the prior DUIs be admissible under 404B?
Well, in this particular instance, the state did not make such a showing, so they didn't ask for it.
Okay.
There was no effort to introduce it into trial.
Did the defense ask for pretrial notice of 404B acts?
My impression is no. There was never any discussion about it, as far as I recall, about 404B considerations.
Okay, thank you.
One of the second factors is whether or not the information that's set forth in the reports at issue, are they closely related to the charged offenses? In this case, much like in Harper, the events that are described in, or the convictions that are described in this media report, are almost identical and mirror the charged offenses that she's facing, thereby indicating, again, that she would have a propensity to commit the offenses for which she's charged should a juror become exposed to this particular information.
Now, the lower court made no finding as to whether the material was inherently prejudicial, or if so, if it created a risk of prejudicing the defendant, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Are we then reviewing for an abuse of discretion, or are you asking us to review essentially the content of the report de novo, since it doesn't appear to be disputed?
Well, actually, the court, you're correct, the trial court did not engage in really the prong one analysis, at least to the extent that it should have. It relied solely upon the admonitions that it had given. So it didn't necessarily assess, although it acknowledged that none of the information was admissible and thereby it was prejudicial. So in essence, yes, Your Honor, you are reviewing the information and deciding whether or not the court complied with step one, that is to say, a full consideration of step one factors in determining whether or not it's actually inherently prejudicial.
Okay, but I'm not sure you answered my question. Are we reviewing for abuse of discretion, or are we applying some other standard, and if so, what?
It is abuse of discretion, whether or not the court moved to step two.
Okay.
Yes, I agree. I think, in essence, my reference to, and your reference to de novo, necessarily entails a consideration of the information about the reports and the factors that Harper outlines in terms of deciding whether or not the court abuses discretion in considering all of those factors. Again, the court only determined really that, or relied upon the fact of the admonitions to basically say that I'm going to rely upon those and basically on faith find that the jury is relying upon my admonitions and are not looking at or reviewing or haven't been exposed to these reports. The problem with that, as Harper identifies, is it's not so much whether or not a juror is going to actually go out and violate the court's instruction. It's really about a matter of inadvertence. And in this day and age, with the internet, with television, with social media, friends, family, neighbors, you name it, it's even more so now that inadvertence is a particular concern. On top of that, take this case. It was a very high-profile case. No one below disputed that. The court was taking steps. It was being firm in its admonition, but nevertheless, even the court said it was recording all of the night's events in terms of news coverage of this particular trial. It was a high-profile trial. In that particular instance, in this particular case, is there a likelihood that the jury would be exposed to this? Absolutely. There's no question about it. So having found that the court necessarily did abuse its discretion in not going to step two, the question becomes the state's assertion that this constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I think a couple of things to consider and keep in mind in that context is that the charged offenses in this case are inextricably linked. That is to say, we're talking about one fund of evidence, one set of factual circumstances. And so it would be basically impossible to to separate, if you will, a juror's consideration of this improper information, this very prejudicial information, and decide on the one hand that some charges are susceptible to harmless beyond a reasonable doubt finding, and other charges are not. My point here is that also, Dunlap, the only case that the state cites for the proposition that it's harmless, is the only published case in Colorado since Harper that finds that this particular kind of error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in Dunlap, the salient facts are that the jury, the concern was that the jury had caught wind of Mr. Dunlap's prior conviction for the Burger King robbery. And in essence, the holding of the Supreme Court was ultimately the jury would learn about this Burger King conviction in the penalty phase of the trial. That is to say, it was properly admitted with proper instructions. On top of that, they found and noted that there was no evidence whatsoever in the record, even on post-conviction review, that any of the jurors actually sitting that heard the case, had heard anything about the Burger King conviction prior to or during the time of the guilt phase of the trial. And so in those particular circumstances, this particular error cannot be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mr. Hare, I have a question about harmlessness, and maybe and part of it is I'm not quite sure I understand the facts. It's my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that after the accident or after the incident or the collision between the cars, the defendant kept on driving to the airport, parked somewhere at the airport, and there was a dog that was going to be transported, and the other woman took the dog. And the defendant waited in the truck.
Correct.
And then decided intentionally to drink alcohol, even though she was still behind the wheel and still intending to drive.
Correct.
After she intentionally drank this very high proof alcohol.
Correct.
So her defense to the jury was, I intended to drive, basically, after I drank this, but this all happened after the incident.
Correct.
So given that she's admitting that she's intending to drink and drive, does that negate the prejudice of this other DUI conviction that the jury might have heard about?
Not at all, because that was her defense. The prosecution's theory was that she was intoxicated at the time of the accident on the highway, in which the van rolled off and went off the highway. And so she raised the defense, what is now classified as a subsequent consumption of alcohol, and it's set forth in the DUI statute. So factually, she raised the defense. The prosecution's theory was that she was intoxicated at the time, that this was not a valid defense, that is, that it didn't happen, or she was already intoxicated, what have you.
Right, and but so, I thought that was the nature of the prejudice that we're worried about from this extraneous information, this notion that in the past she had drank alcohol and then driven. That's the inference you get from the DUI convictions, but then she also admitted to the jury that in this case that's exactly what she was intending to do. So given that was her position about the facts of the case, doesn't that make it less prejudicial that she was convicted of doing the same thing in earlier cases?
I would disagree. I think that the fact of the prior conviction for DUI is that she drives drunk, she drives intoxicated, and that this story is a means to avoid responsibility for the time that involves the vehicular homicide, the charged offense. And so that it would taint her with the prejudice of I have a propensity to drive while intoxicated, and while I have this defense that I didn't get intoxicated until later, we're not going to buy it because look, this is what you do, and this is how you operate. And
okay,
so
thank you. You're
welcome. I see that I have about 4 minutes and 20 seconds. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. In responding to the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in failing to canvass the jury regarding their exposure to mid-trial publicity, I would first like to argue that any error that occurred in this case was the result of invited error. Now, the defendant and defense counsel in this case brought the media report to the court's attention the day that the media report was set to air. They had a lengthy discussion with the court. The court agreed to give a lengthy, very strong-worded advisement to the jury to avoid all media, television, radio, internet. The next morning, after the media report had aired, defense counsel came in, spoke to the court, and he seemed to acknowledge that there was difficulty in deciding which way to go. He talked about the double-edged sword in this case, the risk of drawing the media report to the juror's attention, whether he would be highlighting this report to the jury if they were to instruct the jury on this.
But doesn't he nevertheless specifically request that the jury be canvassed?
He does ultimately say that in an abundance of caution, the court should ask the jury about their exposure to this report. However, I don't think that you can view that comment in isolation. I think you need to review all of defense counsel's comments up until that point, where he seems to be going back and forth about whether or not this would be a good idea to ask the jury. He even says to the court, I don't have a good answer for you, Judge, but I think maybe this is what we should do.
What about the court's final comment that counsel, your record is made? Doesn't that suggest to us that the purposes of, you know, raising an issue contemporaneously have been served because the judge understood what the issue was and made his decision on an informed basis?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In this case, defense counsel never cited to Harper, never referred the court to the three-part test that he's now arguing on appeal. And I think basically looking at the discussion between defense counsel and the court, defense counsel was simply providing his opinion, asking the court for guidance. The court came up with what it thought was the best resolution to resolve this issue, and defense counsel never said another word to the court. Defense counsel never said, no, Your Honor, you need to canvass the jury. Defense counsel, despite having had the entire night to think about this issue, never instructed the court on Harper or the three-part test. And again, never made a single statement after the court said that it declined to discuss this with the jury.
But counsel, I guess I'm confused about what else the defense counsel was supposed to have done. The conclusion of defense counsel's colloquy with the court was, out of an abundance of caution, I think you should make inquiry. The court then explained why it was doing what it's doing and said, therefore, I decline to make inquiry. The court, what should defense counsel say? Well, no, I want to repeat my point. Please think about it again. I mean, what is defense counsel supposed to do?
Well, again, I think had defense counsel pointed the court toward Harper, that would have made a difference. Had the court said, we have Harper, here is the three-part test, the court needs to do this, that would be one thing. But we don't have that. We have defense counsel saying, well, Your Honor, it's a double-edged sword. Well, I have some concerns about highlighting this issue for the jury if we ask them about this. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know what to tell you, Judge. I don't have a good answer for you, but here's what I think. I don't think defense counsel was advocating for a specific course of action for the trial court. I think defense counsel was providing the court with his thoughts and insights and asking the court for guidance. The court provided that guidance, and defense counsel did not at any point disagree with the court's chosen course of action. But in any event, I do not think that the court abused its discretion in this case by failing to canvass the jury. Now, the first step in the Harper analysis is to determine whether the coverage has the potential for unfair prejudice. In making that determination, it's not simply whether or not the content of the report was prejudicial to the defendant. Harper goes through and looks at multiple factors that the court has to weigh to determine whether or not there was the potential for unfair prejudice based on this media report. So we do look at the content, of course, which we have here. We have a prior DUI, we have information that the defendant was driving on a suspended license at the time of the offense in this case.
Do the people contend that our review is in any way limited because the actual report is not in the record, or since the prosecutor didn't take issue with what the court said was in the report, may we take that as that's the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We have to look at whether or not this evidence would be admissible at trial. Now, of course, this was not introduced as 404B evidence. It's possible the evidence could have come in as impeachment evidence because the defendant did testify here. We also have to look at how closely related the publicity is to the matters at issue in this trial.
Well, let me stop you. Didn't the court specifically say this stuff isn't coming in?
The court did say that. Had certain testimony come out during her examination, that could have changed. It did not in this case.
Did the court actually make a finding one way or the other as to prejudice, in your view?
I believe that it did, yes, Your Honor. I believe that it looked at factors regarding whether or not this was unduly prejudicial by looking at the likelihood that the jury was exposed to this media report in this case, which is one of the factors that Harper tells us to look at. As well as the admonishments that were given in this case. This isn't a case like Harper where we have the court advising the jury to avoid any newspaper articles about this particular case. This is a case that was plagued with media attention from the very beginning. There was a great deal of discussion about publicity from the point of jury selection on. The court was admonishing the jury every single day about avoiding media reports.
My question was really whether you believe that the court made a finding one way or the other as to whether the information in the telecast was prejudicial.
I do, Your Honor.
And you think which way?
I think that the court found that this was not unduly prejudicial by looking at all of the factors that are listed in Harper, including the likelihood that the jury was exposed, the admonishments provided by the court, the effectiveness of the court's instructions to avoid the media. These are all factors that the court must look at in determining whether or not there was a potential for unfair prejudice. And the court did look at those things regarding the admonishments that it gave to the jury, the fact that when it gave those admonishments, the jury nodded, was very serious. Those are the types of things that the court has to consider in making its decision.
In your view, is that sufficient under Harper simply to make strong and frequent admonishments to the jury?
I think so, coupled with everything else that we have here. Again, like I said, this case is not like Harper, where we have a single admonishment asking the jury to avoid newspaper articles about that particular case. The concern in Harper was that there could be inadvertent exposure even if the jury followed the court's instructions. We don't have that here. The court was very clear with the jury that they were to avoid all news, all media, TV, radio, internet. They were not to listen to any news reports, watch any news programs. They weren't to go on Facebook and follow anything there regarding news reports.
Did the court specifically refer to Facebook or social media?
It did, yes.
So did the court admonish them not to use the internet at all?
Initially it said no internet, no TV, no radio. Subsequently, the court said, if you must, avoid all news media.
So they could have been on the internet and inadvertently come across it, couldn't they, this news?
Not unless they were to access the news channel's website, which would have been specifically against what the court had ordered the jury to do. It had specifically ordered them to avoid all news media, whether that was television, radio, or internet. So while they could have watched a program on television, they were not allowed to watch any news media.
So you think that the only way to get news on the internet is to go to a news website?
Well, the only information that we have in the record is that this media report was played on Channel 4 and that it appeared in an online article for Channel 4. We don't have any evidence that this media report was made available on any other website or in any other place on television, radio, or internet. The only information we have is that which is contained in the record.
But isn't the reason why we don't have more information because the trial court refused to ask the jury about it?
No, Your Honor. What defense counsel brought forward was that this media report was played on television the night before and that there was a written article as well. There was never any allegation that any of this appeared anywhere else. And to the extent that in Harper, the court was also concerned that there was a possibility of friends and family maybe hearing this and inadvertently sharing that with the jurors. In this case, we have instructions about that too. Right after the jury was sworn in, the court instructed the jury that they were not to talk to anyone about this case and that no one was to talk to them. And that if they were in a position where they overheard anyone talking about this case, that they were to walk away and report that contact to the court or the court staff. So we have admonishments that go far beyond anything that was contained in Harper. We have the court continually admonishing the jury to avoid all news coverage. So there isn't a situation where the jury could have inadvertently come across this news article while looking at other news because they weren't allowed to watch any news.
Well, we don't know whether they actually watched the Channel 9 for news. Wouldn't it have been a simple inquiry simply to say, did any members of the jury happen to see the Channel 4 newscast last night?
The court certainly could have asked that question, Your Honor, but it wasn't required to by Harper. Again, we have an abuse of discretion standard here, and the court is to analyze whether or not there's a potential for unfair prejudice based on this news report. And in making that determination, the court has to consider both the admonishments that it's given to the jury, the likelihood that the jury was actually exposed to this, and along with the other things as far as the content of the media report.
So far as you're concerned, did the court make a finding that the content was inherently prejudicial?
Well, it's not as simple as that, Your Honor, because whether or not the content was prejudicial doesn't answer the question under the first prong of Harper, which is whether or not the media report had the potential for unfair prejudice.
I'm trying to refine that. Isn't the first step to look at the content?
The content is one factor that the court should consider.
Okay. Did the court make a finding as to whether or not the content standing alone was inherently prejudicial?
It did not make a finding based on the content alone, no, Your Honor.
Since the content is undisputed, can we essentially make that finding on a de novo basis?
The court can certainly look at the content that was discussed by the court and the parties as far as what was contained in that media report, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But again, the court has to then go further and take that along with the admonishment and the likelihood that the jury was exposed. And again, this was a case where publicity was discussed at length from the very beginning of this trial. The jury was publicity was discussed during jury selection. The jurors were admonished daily about avoiding any media reports. And in this case, the parties were aware prior to this report being released that this report was coming out. So they had the opportunity to provide sort of a preemptive instruction to the jury, knowing that this was coming out. This wasn't a situation where they were caught off guard or were surprised by the media report. They actually knew this report was coming out and were able to address this issue with the jury prior to the report airing. And ultimately, the people would also argue that any error in this case was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt due to the overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case.
Well, doesn't that aspect of your argument assume that the defendant's version of what happened, that she drank only after the accident, is so lacking in credibility that the jury couldn't have bought it?
Well, I do think it was so lacking in credibility. In this case, the prosecution presented evidence from, they had experts regarding blood alcohol content who were able to take the defendant's subsequent blood alcohol tests and determined that she was a 0.274 at the time of the accident in this case. And based on the amount of time that it would take for her body to process the alcohol and reach that peak, the expert testified that it would take at least 30 minutes. So if she was a .274 at the time of the accident, she had to drink prior to that in order to reach that level at that time. So there was quite a bit of scientific evidence that the defendant was drunk at the time of the accident, as well as witness accounts and, of course, accident reconstructionist testimony as well.
So is it your position that no reasonable jury could have believed the defendant?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then how could it be harmless error? Because if a jury could have believed her, then she would have been acquitted.
No juror could have believed her.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the answer is yes. No jury could have believed her.
Yes,
I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
If the court has no...
I have one.
Yes.
On the admonition to the jurors the trial court gave repeatedly, I thought you said, and I want to make sure this is true, the court said if you are exposed to news information about this case, inadvertently or otherwise, you should let me know.
What the court said... what the court said was if anyone tries to talk to you or if you overhear others talking about any party, witness, evidence, or anything else about this case, walk away and immediately notify me or my staff who will notify me.
Okay.
That's what the court instructed the jury.
Okay, thank you.
The court has no further questions. We would ask that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
May it please the court. With respect to the court's decision not to poll the jury, Harper basically says that even if, under the state's view, if you have concerns going one way or the other, the doubt is resolved in polling the jury to find out whether or not they have been exposed to this particular information. Judge Navarro, you were asking about inadvertence. In this particular day and age, indeed, news articles and news information are linked up to all the social media that the court had talked about that is on the internet. There are other means of gaining this particular information, whether on your phone, whether it's happenstance on an email from a friend, etc. The number of instances in which inadvertence can take place today are far more numerous than they were back in with respect to Harper.
Mr. Harris, given the court's repeated admonition about avoiding news reports about the case, do you think that if a juror had been exposed inadvertently, the juror would have said something to the trial court?
Not necessarily, because the admonition is basically you're not to do that. It doesn't really cover inadvertence. It doesn't cover the comment by the neighbor, the comment by the friend, seeing the headline. Seeing one paragraph and realizing, oops, this is an inadvertent reviewing, but I'm not violating the particular, the court's admonition, the court's instruction. Secondly, the reference to the jurors nodding, the court only said that several of the jurors nodded their head. What that means, I'm not sure, but even if we take it in the light most favorable to the state, which the court shouldn't, nodding their head to what? We're not really clear on what. The other jurors didn't. What does that mean? The point is that you resolve the doubt in favor of polling to find out. It's a simple question. And counsel's so-called going back and forth and really thinking out loud, not sure whether this is a good idea or not, at least at the outset, is a valid concern. It's referenced in Harper. But the point is that the court can frame and craft a general question to the jury as a whole, as a group, with regard to media contact, media exposure. That's the way it's done. Not citing Harper is not a problem at all. That doesn't unpreserve the issue. Harper's been around for 25 years. It's a simple three-step process. This is how we've dealt with it for 25 years. The cases that I've read over 25 years, whether the lawyer references Harper or not, the issue is, the question is, Your Honor, please poll the jury to see whether or not they have been exposed to this media information. That's the way it's done in Colorado. With respect to Ms. Jacobson's defense, there were numerous witnesses who confirmed that at the time that she was stopped, that there was no indicia of intoxication. And so there was a valid defense, it was a valid subsequent consumption defense that she had raised. And I think that's important for the court to consider.
Didn't witnesses also say, sorry to interrupt you, didn't witness also say that even after she admittedly drank alcohol, she still didn't exhibit signs of intoxication? So it just seems like whether she exhibited signs is immaterial. It doesn't really point one way or the other about whether she actually had drank alcohol.
It's a factor that weighs in favor of her defense. It's something for the jury to consider, certainly. And in context of all of the other evidence that that the jury had for them, it was something that certainly there was credibility on both sides. It was something for them to consider. But certainly that evidence supported her notion that she had consumed the alcohol after she had stopped driving after the event in question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, we would ask that Your Honors reverse Ms. Jacobson's convictions. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Since this case exhausts our afternoon docket, the bailiff may announce a recess.